Lifestyle.
You'll forgive me if I don't stay around to watch. I just can't cope with the freaky stuff.
Welcome to the New Flesh Podcast, a podcast about horror movies and all things tangentially related to horror, horror movies, and the horror lifestyle. This week, we have two main events. And since, Jesse, I thought this was actually perfect that we ended up putting these two together rather than split them up into separate episodes, because both these movies cannibalize each other at the box office. So they may as well cannibalize each other on our episode about the movie. That is my co-host, Jesse Hassinger, at Rock Marooned on Twitter. We are here to talk about Renfield, the Universal picture, a Universal monster movie in a way, but a Universal monster movie this ain't your grandpappy's Universal monster movie, I guess would be how you would say that. I don't know why you'd say it that way, but I chose to. And The Pope's Exorcist. You're probably wondering, what about a stupid song for one or both of these songs or movies? And I couldn't think of any, but since we hit record 55 seconds ago, I thought of a couple, so I'm not going to do any backing tracks, because if you've noticed, when I do background music lately, it sounds bad because I'm too lazy to actually edit separate tracks, so I just leave it all on one track. I'm sorry, everybody. So let's just do an a cappella version. You know the Police song, Roxanne, Jesse?
Of course, yeah.
Renfield. You don't have to eat those bugs tonight. All right, that worked, right? Okay. We'll count that one. The Pope's Exorcist, a movie that's very, I'm doing like the Italian chef's kiss hand right now.
A very
Italian film, to the tune of, are you familiar with That's Amore?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, something like, when the priest hits your rye, cause the devil's a guy. The devil's inside. Oh, that's so much better. We have to workshop these in real time. Look at the progress we've had here. When the moon hits your eye, or no, what was it? When a priest hits your eye, cause the devil's inside. That's the Pope's Exorcist. Yeah. what was it?
That's the Pope. Yeah,
it's the Pope. Very good. The Pope's Exorcist, starring Russell Crowe as a very Italian man. And he commits to that performance to a degree that I think made it work for Jesse, but it didn't quite bring me to that level. But I appreciate that he elevated the material as much as he could. He really commits to it. The movie does this hilarious thing where it's like, you're so Italian, please speak English for the benefit of the board or whatever. Like, it's just these really weird things where instead of like just being English or just being Italian, it's in Italian until Italian people go, no,
please speak in English.
We're speaking English here on this board for reasons I don't quite understand. It's an interesting movie. Renfield's an interesting movie. I'm excited to talk about both. Jesse, I wanted to bring this up right away because I have it in my notes and I'll forget. Do you get this? Has there been a movie this year that Sony isn't ashamed of? Sony, and I think Jesse knows what I mean, but the listener, you probably don't know what I mean. I mean that movies get screened for critics most of the time. And Sony, as far as I can tell, the last couple, and I think the next one as well, which I'll mention in a bit, it seems that they've all been the Sony's not screening it for critics, but if you happen to live in New York or in LA, you can come to our offices and watch it at our screening room. And we'll call that a critic screening, which technically it is, but for people on a deadline, it's not super helpful, et cetera, et cetera. So do you get my drift? Do you have an answer to my question?
I was trying to look up the Sony schedule so I could see, or, you know, the release, the movies of the year so far, so I could see the last time a Sony movie, because, you know, Man Called Otto, certainly they made very available, but that was last year's film.
Yes.
So I'm trying to think if there's anything in 2022 that they have.
According to my calendar, the first movie of the year for them was 65 on March 10th. And that was very much we're ashamed of this movie type of style release. And the Pope's Exorcist got the same one. And at the end of the month, there's another one. There's a it was once untitled. Now we have a title. It's called, like, it has actually a hilarious title. It is
Big George Foreman, the miraculous story of the once and future heavyweight champion of the world.
Did you really just memorize it? That's really
good. I was looking at the release schedule. Sorry.
I was super impressed. That is as funny a title as 65 million years ago, a visitor crash landed on Earth or whatever. I think that's the official title of 65.
Sony is there. Not only do they have a faith-based George Foreman biopic, which I assume will not be screened, although sometimes they screen those further ahead than you would think, the faith-based ones, because they're just hoping that someone will have a conversion experience.
I asked our lovely contact at Sony, who I genuinely, I'm not trying to be mean, she's lovely. She always
will get back to it. Even, I feel like a lot of studios, they would just be like, no, but she does say, here, you can see this movie.
It has happened to me with a different studio called Warner Brothers. They do not like me or something, and they didn't feel faith in Shazam 2 enough to make it available to me specifically.
Yeah.
But the person at Sony, who is lovely, I did email after, because of the post-exorcist we were talking about or whatever, scheduling, and I was like, is this coming soon? Are you handling? And she said yes, but there's no screening set yet. So I presume...
Their next one is a candidate for this too, because the one after this was just moved up a week to come out opposite Guardians of the Galaxy. Love Again, comedy. It's a romantic comedy. I think it's about like a widower and a single woman played by the chick who's married to the Jonas Priyanka.
Priyanka Chopra. Okay.
Yeah.
Oddly, I do know who you mean.
Yeah, of course, sure. She's on like the Amazon show that looks really janky. They showed previews for in the movie
she
theater.
She was in the Baywatch movie, I think.
Yeah. She's very, very pretty. I'm sure she's got some charisma. But it looks it's one of those ones where you're like, oh, so Sony actually is putting this out. It's not like Roadside Attractions or like something like that.
Well, let's put putting it out in air quotes.
Yeah. Well, that's coming out May 5th, and I don't imagine there's going to be long lead screenings of that one. Above the title billing in that one goes to Celine Dion, because she has what looks like a cameo. I saw the trailer. I think it's one of those things I'm going to have to see just because it looks like something. I don't know what's going on over at Sony. I like them. They make littler movies or mid movies. Sony always has like this, and this is will relate to Pope's Exorcist. And what I was thinking of when writing about it is that Sony really has never stopped making the little movies and the kind of mid-level movies that the other studios often will, you know, forsake in favor of doing 6 tentpoles a year. Sony always has like some little stuff cooking because they've got so many different labels. They got Columbia, TriStar, Screen Gems, Stage 6, which is like nominally their direct to streaming arm, but often puts things out in the theaters first. They seem to really, for whatever other, you know, faults, they seem to really get almost to a fault sometimes with Sony Classics that you need to have some kind of, it helps to have some kind of theatrical release component, even if the movie's not going to be a big hit. Like Sony Classics was like the most stubborn about never going direct to streaming with stuff that probably should have gone direct to streaming like during 2020. They were like just holding it. They wouldn't even put it on demand, you know, for rental for $20. I remember trying to watch the Burnt Oren Hearsay for a long time. And it was like months.
Yeah, a movie that absolutely exists for sure. People
exactly. Yeah. Anyway, that's just to say, Sony puts out a lot of movies, so they can't show them all to us, I guess.
So Sony really took the mantle from, who was it in COVID who, well, your running joke was they hate releasing movies. It was Paramount, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, Paramount. Yeah.
Well, Paramount really turned a corner. They're really releasing movies.
Sony really loves releasing movies, but almost maybe they love it too much. Which is great. I joke, but I do actually really like this. The Screen Games label, which put out Pope's Exorcist, I'm always kind of excited when I see that against all reason, rational reason. And we'll get into that, I think, as we talk about that movie some more.
Well, Sony does have some stuff coming up in the summer. They have Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which will be huge for them.
Yes. Yes.
And they have, well, Bert Kreischer, who's a very famous comedian, who I've been a fan of for, like, I saw him when I lived in L.A., so that was a decade ago. He has it was probably the first time he started telling this story. I don't know when it started, but I saw it about 10 years ago. He was on Doug Benson's comedy show that I would always go to, and he told a story called The Machine. It's about his time in Russia, I think on like a study abroad trip or something, and how he fell in with the mob over there. And of course, it's a story that is embellished for stand-up comedy, and I don't assume it to be very true, but they turned it into a movie.
Oh, and, interesting.
Yeah, Mark Hamill is starring in it as Bert's dad, and I think Bert is in it as himself. And Bert Kreischer, maybe a polarizing comedian, but I think he's funny. The movie's coming out May 26th, and I don't know if that's going to be a real one or a We're Ashamed of It one. But they got the Jennifer Lawrence one, which they're already plastering everywhere. So that'll
yes,
be a hit,
yes.
I think.
I think
I turned to you and said that'll make $150 million or
yeah,
something.
I agree. Every time I've seen the trailer, it plays. I feel like I think I saw that trailer again later that evening in front of Renfield, and it plays. People like, I mean, I think it's funny too, and I think that I think that is going to do really well.
Harold and the Purple Crayon kids movie.
I don't think that's actually coming out. I feel like that's been on the schedule for like 10 years.
Ooh, interesting. They have Insidious on the schedule, but they have the wrong title. So we'll talk about that in bits and pieces. Let's move into bits and pieces. Let's get right into it. The first one, Insidious, the new title for Insidious 5, to be directed, or already, I guess, already has been directed by Patrick Wilson, returning to the franchise as for the first time as a director, but he's also in it. Insidious, The Red Door. Nice pairing with the previous film, which was called Insidious, The Last Key.
Ooh.
So the key and the door. What's next? Insidious, The Scary Hinge.
Yes,
I'm think of more
more door stuff. There's not that much. There aren't that many features.
There's not a lot of door things.
There's just usually doors are pretty much. I guess this is just gonna sound gross. You know, Insidious, The Dark Knob.
Ooh, it could just be a British asshole, though.
Yeah. He's a right dark knob, isn't he?
a real spooky wreath or something. Yeah. I don't know.
That's the Christmas one. I'd love to see that. This Insidious Christmas movie.
I hope the good people at Sony. I'm assuming they're listening because they got wind that we're doing this episode is talking about their business and their schedule and how they operate. So hopefully they're listening and they can get the spooky wreath into production for Christmas next year. Insidious: The Red Door. The previous title, according to one of these schedules I was just looking at, was Fear of the Dark. So maybe they'll save that one. Maybe they're putting that one in the back pocket.
Maybe they just were like, that sounds like six other horror movies. So I like it. I'd like stick with the door thing. I think that's better. It's cleaner.
It is cleaner. Josh Lambert, Patrick Wilson, heads east to drop off his son Dalton, played by the same kid who played him in the first movie, returning as a college age person, presumably. I think time has passed. I don't know how time works. He's dropped off at an idyllic ivy-covered university. However, Dalton's college dream becomes a nightmare when the repressed demons of his past suddenly return to haunt them both. And Jesse, I think we've already mentioned that Rose Byrne is also returning.
Yes.
As Mrs. Lambert.
Very exciting to me.
I think this is definitely a sneaky pick for most anticipated horror movie of the year. I know that Last Key was like mildly disappointing. Like it was fine, I think. But I just really like this franchise. And I'd really liked the third one in particular. Is this the fifth or the sixth? The fifth?
This is the fifth.
Yeah, okay. That all tracks then, because there's not one I'm missing in my head. I really like 3. So 4 was a step down, and this sounds like a step back in the right direction of they're focusing on, you know, the original characters. And I remember being tough on Insidious 2, and I'm really interested in revisiting it because I remember it being really like ambitious and interesting. I just like wasn't connected with it. Isn't he like in the other world for most of it or something?
I think so. I don't remember. I fully reviewed it, but I don't remember much about it. But I just generally have a good time with these movies. They're pretty consistent, I find. So
Have we ever covered one together? I think Last Key came out before you did it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think so.
Maybe we should do, that's an easy short series to commit to of like doing those before that comes out in July. Hopefully, I'm assuming there'll be a lull in the summer where we can do that, because lately I feel like there hasn't been a lull. Maybe we stretched last week for Pipeline, but I would argue, and maybe I said this on the pod last week, but like our ecological crisis is a horror movie. Maybe.
Yes, you could argue that. I think May and June is when you have a little bit of a, there's a couple, The Boogeyman is coming out in June. Okay. And I think there's like one other one, but there is kind of a stretch where in May and June where there are not that many horror movies coming out until Insidious. So I think that makes sense.
Right on. Insidious, The Red Door, get excited. I wanted to mention, Jesse, that Scream 6 has officially crossed 100 million, and that was like 10 days ago. So presumably it's crossed, you know, 110 or 115 or something by now. Scream 6 is the first movie in the franchise to cross 100 million since Scream 2 back in 1997. Wow. So, yeah, Scream 6, I think we made the very obvious prediction, Jesse, on the show. I think Tracking was saying the same thing, that it was going to perform very well and be the best performing in the franchise, at least opening weekend wise. And it's interesting that panned out to be true of the whole run. So I'm fat, you know, we haven't heard about Scream 7 yet. And there's actually some news that I have. I'm struggling to find where I put that link because I should have had it next. There isn't any announcement about Scream 7 yet. But there is an announcement about Radio Silence's next movie. So is Radio Silence stepping away from the Scream movies? Are the Scream movies getting put on hold for a minute? The news here is that the Scream 6 filmmaking team, Radio Silence, is tackling a Universal monster movie for Universal, a horror movie, obviously. The Universal's keeping plot details in the coffin. Jesse, guess what character this project centers around in the Dark Universe?
Dracula.
Yep.
More Dracula.
It's a third Dracula project from Universal before we've heard anything about any other sort of Universal monster thing since The Invisible Man. Presumably what you'd think it did was set the template for them to do a tour or whatever you want to call it, filmmaker driven remakes of things that are like, that I don't know, that work, that are good.
Yeah.
And instead they had the Dark Universe, which failed and led to that. And now they're back to Renfeld. Feels like this was maybe supposed to be a Dark Universe thing that they retooled, or it more feels like something that they picked up from a drawer from like 12 years ago based on the humor in it. But that doesn't make sense because it's a spec script from like a younger guy. So it's all very confusing. But I say all that to say, another bit of news. All the news is becoming one, Jesse. All the news is becoming
it's
one.
It's all
bit
converging
today.
Into one place.
It is. There's another Universal Dracula movie of which the trailer premiered with Renfeld. I'm sure you saw it.
Yes.
I didn't see it because I saw Renfeld at a press screening and they don't do that. So I haven't watched the trailer because I don't watch them. But the trailer for The Last Voyage of the Demeter, directed by Andre Overdahl, director of one of my favorite recent horror indies, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, also director of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which I didn't like that much. But they're doing The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which is like the dramatization or whatever you want to call it. It's not a real thing, so I guess that's not the right word. But it's the part of Dracula where he's taken on a boat and goes from Transylvania to London or whatever.
Yes, yes.
That's the movie. And so it's another Dracula movie. So Universal has gone from Dark Universe that failed because Tom Cruise's The Mummy was bad. And it derailed the Bride of Frankenstein and Jekyll and Hyde that was set up and all whatever else, whatever the fuck else. And then they went to Invisible Man, which should have been the model and I thought was and maybe still is, but they keep forgetting. And now we're at some weird stage where they're just like 15 Dracula things, please.
Yeah. It's very strange. It really does kind of feel like it went quickly from we have a new model to kind of right before the Dark Universe where they're like, well, we have these things, I guess we can let, it's kind of this half-assed version. Like it does follow the kind of the path of let's give these, like, give different filmmakers different monsters and or the same monsters even, and let them have different takes on it or whatever. And some of them can be funny and some of them can be scary and some of them can be different, these, you know, different tones, different styles. But it doesn't feel like an event the way even the Invisible Man, though it wasn't like a big tentpole summer movie thing and was kind of kneecapped by the pandemic, it still kind of felt,
still was a hit.
It was a big hit, and it felt like a big deal leading up to it. Like a kind of like, ooh, this is going to be cool. Like this is a, you know, kind of marquee Invisible Man movie. And that has not really been, as much as they, I think they have done a good job, this marketing Renfield, and the trailer for Last Voyage of the Demeter looks cool. The movie looks awesome. Like, I mean, it looks, I don't, maybe that's overselling it, but I thought it looked cool. I was like psyched to see it. I wish every time that I go see a crummy Dracula movie, that there'll be a trailer in front of the Dracula movie saying, well, if you don't like this one, we got another Dracula movie that's completely
different. Well, your wish has come true, man. It is absolutely happening.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. Okay, so this one, I don't think I ever got to it. The project was at one point titled Dracula's Daughter. That project centered on a group of kidnappers who abduct a band of young people, one of whom ends up being Dracula. Woe then befalls the kidnappers. The script for that untitled project was written by Stephen Shields with revisions by Guy Busick. Guy Busick, writer of Scream 6, Scream 5, and I think he also did Ready or Not with the Radio Silence guys. It's funny because I don't consider them a part of Radio Silence, but you basically can, right?
Yeah.
Like they keep working with him. He is their writer at this point. And Vanderbilt. Anyway, Universal is noting the project falls in the lane of such films as Lee Wannell's The Invisible Man and the upcoming and Renfield. They said in Hollywood Reporter they called Renfield Adam McKay's take on a Dracula side character, which is just incorrect.
Great reporting. Good job, guys.
Dracula's Daughter, incidentally, was a classic Universal horror movie produced in 1936 as a loose sequel to 1931's Dracula.
Yes.
Well, I think this sounds like it could be fun, but I gotta say, I'm a little Dracula'd out. Maybe, I mean, Voyage of the Demeter, I guess, a lot's riding on that one. if it doesn't perform, which I don't know if it will, I don't think, like, does Dracula's Daughter still happen even? Like, it feels like they're, why are they putting all their fucking chips in on Dracula?
It's very strange, yeah, you would think they would just try to, you know, you could still do this, but have other things in between them and then have a Dracula every 2 or 3 years rather than stacking them up like this. It's interesting that it's not, so this doesn't have anything to do with Dracula's Daughter from 1936, the actual kind of, that's bizarre. Cause like you could, I mean, this sounds like a cool enough premise, but you could also like, there are so many older Universal monster sequels that are not that well known that you could easily riff on, you know, do very loose redos of and just take the premise and do something more.
Doesn't that sound like low effort, like something you could easily do? It's funny that they keep going with like, we need zany premises that are new ways in that could be described as famously as not your grandpappy's Universal monster movies.
Yeah.
It's weird that they did Renfield and then they're also doing, what if Dracula's daughter was kidnapped?
What I really need at this point is a update from someone about that Wolfman movie, because I feel like that was, you know, that guy, that Gosling, Derek Cianfrance Wolfman movie felt
and
like that.
Cianfrance took over after, I think it was Lee Wannell, I never know if it's Wannell or Wannell. I knew at one point.
that is more in the vein of this Invisible Man thing. Like you're going to have a version of the Wolfman by this sort of, you know, a vision driven director and this very particular star who he's worked with. That sounded very cool to me. And I feel like all the last updates about it were like last July. So I just need to know more. That would kind of calm my fears about this kind of them. I do like that they're using the Universal monsters a lot, that they don't seem to be precious about it. Like, I think part of the problem with the Dark Universe thing was that it all kind of depended on this, you know, these interconnected things all working. And when you're doing it like this, it doesn't matter really. If Renfield bombs, that doesn't mean that the next Dracula movie is going to bomb, because if nobody saw Renfield, which was mostly the case this weekend.
Oh, yeah, it bombed. We'll talk about it.
Then nobody even knows that there was, you know, necessarily another Dracula movie, or they aren't thinking about Renfield when they're buying a ticket to the next one. So that's smart in some respects, but you also want to kind of feel like there is a kind of not a literal continuity, but a feeling of like, oh yeah, the Universal Monster label means something more than just like it's going to have a monster from their catalog in it.
And we'll talk about this when we talk about Renfield, but we both love Nick Cage in Renfield to the point where I'm like, well, you should put him in more stuff as Dracula. But like, clearly that's not going to pan out with how this movie performed. And we have to kind of reckon with, I think they were trying to see if Nick Cage had that star power anymore to like bring butts to seats. And I think two movies in a row that have had what I would consider very expansive marketing campaigns, even though I think The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent really botched the marketing campaign still. I still think that movie had a terrible title. It was very hard to understand what it was. I think if you called it like the Nicolas Cage movie or whatever, like some dumb fucking title, you know, if you focus group that one, you could have worked it out. But like, I still think the end result, as Renfield is proving, because Renfield did have much awareness, I would say, as Nick Cage's Dracula in this movie. And it bombed. It bombed very bad. Is that because of Nick Cage's Dracula specifically? No, I would probably argue it's because Renfield looked bad and is bad. But I think Nick Cage's Dracula gets wrapped up in that, and we're not going to see him in any more big things for a while. But we'll talk about that later. Amazon is reportedly looking to revive RoboCop with potential television series. So we all know that Amazon bought MGM. So here's the things they've ID'd as initial titles for film or TV development. Are you ready? Should I let you guess? That'd be kind of fun. Do you have any? RoboCop's one.
Boy.
I'll give you a hint. The next one's like sci-fi. Haven't done one of these in a long time. I think a 90s property in my mind.
A 90s property they haven't done in a long time. MGM. I don't know.
Search, I don't know if you'd ever get that. It's Stargate.
Oh, yeah. Sure. That was people love that on TV, I'm to understand. So that makes sense.
Stargate SG-1 is a title I know, even though I've seen zero episodes of that. I don't even know what. I'm assuming Stargate SG also means Stargate. But I don't know. I'm assuming. The next one is a comedy with a very famous person at the center.
I think I saw a headline about this. It's Legally Blonde, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's movie or TV, but Legally Blonde is a film that they've been trying to get off the ground, the third one. The next one, I don't know how to tease it. I'll just say it's Fame. The next one is a comedy starring Ice Cube, the franchise.
Oh, is that like, are we there yet? Or are we?
No.
Is it Friday? Because that was a Warner Brothers thing, I thought.
No, it's a different one. Am I saying? No, Ice Cube's in that. Cedric the Entertainer is in these, famously.
Oh, Barbershop. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Barbershop. We've got a movie that was remade with Chris Pratt. iconic movie.
Oh, The Magnificent Seven?
Yes. A movie that was remade with Steve Martin, iconically.
Bringing Down the House. No, Roxanne, probably, right?
No, Beyonce's in one of these movies.
Oh, Pink Panther. Oh, boy.
And the last one, this was remade in the 90s with, I'll give you the second build, not the top build. How about Rene Russo?
Rene Russo. Oh, Thomas Crown Affair. Yeah.
That was
be sexy.
It was a fun game. Okay.
good picture.
Amazon is, okay, so Legally Blonde is both a third movie and a potential TV series. Stargate is both a movie and a potential TV series. RoboCop is also a potential movie and a TV series, with a TV series first. So they have plans, weirdly. They're like, no, that one will be a TV show first. We know that.
Yeah.
And then TV shows are Fame, Barbershop, and Magnificent Seven. And Thomas Crown Affair is a movie, as well as a Pink Panther movie, which could be animated. A Poltergeist project also is possible down the line. And Deadline already revealed plans for a Creed universe that spans movies, TV, and an anime. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of shit. Does any of that interest you at all?
Nope. No.
I mean,
not really.
Not really.
Yeah. I those are all things I've enjoyed in the past, more or less. But I, you know, it just doesn't it feel like they're like 5 years
really
late.
You just really summed up the state of modern everything. Yeah.
I used to enjoy. I loved the Pink Panther movies when I was a kid. You know, it does kind of feel like 5 years late. Isn't that what everyone was doing 5 years ago? And didn't this bubble burst? It's weird that they're still like, we're going to make a TV series, a manga, you know, and six movies. Like, okay, well, good luck with that.
Next bit and piece. There's a new Pete Davidson show that it revolves around Pete Davidson's real life. And I only mention it because Art the Clown from Terrifier appears in the trailer for the movie, for the show, in a very inexplicable way that I don't understand. But the director of the Terrifier was posted on Instagram and was very excited, so I had to mention that. Melissa Barrera, Jesse, I should have mentioned this a minute ago. I didn't see it until just now. Melissa Barrera is actually apparent. I bet she's going to be Dracula's daughter in that movie because she just got cast in that movie with Radio Silence. So I guess she's fun to work with. That's what you got to take away from that, right?
I don't know. I liked her in, you know what? This is not a horror movie, but I liked her in the upcoming Carmen.
I did not like that movie very much.
It's a strange movie, but I kind of like, I gave it a pass for whatever reason.
I like the lady who's in all the Almodovar movies, who's in that. She gives a good performance.
Yeah.
In the vein of studios, recent hits like Invisible Man or Renfield, the entitled monster thriller provides a unique take on legendary monster lore and will represent a fresh new direction for how to celebrate these characters. Universal monster films are rooted in the horror genre with no restrictions on budget, rating, or genre. They are not a part of shared or connected universe, which allows each film to stand on its own. This new direction is filmmaker-driven, inviting innovative filmmakers with original, bold ideas for these characters to develop the stories and pitch them. So, Jesse, am I missing... Did I, like, miss the forest for the trees in my analysis? Like, is this... like what I'm talking about, like the Invisible Man led to this movement where they're doing filmmaker driven stuff, and that filmmaker driven stuff is Renfield and Dracula's daughter.
I feel like they kind of retcon Renfield into this strategy, but Dracula's daughter by the Radio Silence guys, I can
does
see
kind
that.
Of fit
that,
yeah,
makes,
okay.
that kind of works.
Rebecca McKendry, who did Glorious, a movie on Shudder that I didn't love, is back with another how do you call those movies? What do you call those movies? Single location premise, I guess. It's a movie called Elevator Game. It comes out August 11th. So it's already shot. It will premiere on Shudder, or it was acquired by Shudder. Elevator Game follows socially awkward teenager Ryan, who ingratiates himself into a group of recent high school graduates that run an online web series debunking urban legends to find her sister, who disappeared months earlier, probably while taking the dangerous challenge. Playing the game involves riding the elevator in a specific sequence to invoke a supernatural creature called the Fifth Floor Woman. That sounds like a true crime thing that was on Netflix. I forget what it was called. It might have been like the Cecil Hotel one. I forget.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There's definitely a true crime thing that like involved people, basically because online sleuths got a hold of this weird video of the elevator. And uh-huh. They made up all these like things around it. Like, oh, there's a ghost there. She saw a ghost. Like, it's just horse shit. But this sounds like they made a horror movie with that premise, which is kind of cool. So I was wrong about the single location thing. But the elevator thing tricked me at first. We mentioned the HBO Max. Have I mentioned HBO Max things? No, I haven't. HBO Max pivoted to being called Max, I guess. And in that announcement came a lot of stuff, and I'm trying to figure out what the one I wanted to talk about was. Oh, The Conjuring. The Conjuring is becoming a TV show at Max. How do you feel about this, Jesse?
You know, I'm not going to watch it probably because that's a big time commitment for The Conjuring. I haven't even seen The Nun yet, so I, you know.
Oh, but... wow. You gotta watch The Nun before.
I gotta catch up with The Nun, yeah.
In September. And the last Conjuring was pretty disappointing. The Devil Made Me Do It.
Yes.
Famously, same day HBO Max theatrical release that I'm presuming did not do very well at the box office. Maybe I'm wrong. That franchise
did okay.
Well.
It did okay, but it was, you know, it was not a huge hit.
It was hampered. But yeah, the Conjuring drama is probably the only thing that I need to mention in that many annoying announcement thing that happened. The trailer for Sanctuary came out, Neon's psychosexual thriller starring Margaret Qualley and Christopher Abbott. I have to miss a screening of that this week. I'm going to catch it in May. Are you going this week?
I have to check. I'm not. I probably am not. I'll probably will also go in May. But I'm. It looked. I saw the trailer in front of something I watched. But was afraid, I think, and it looked good.
Nice. I haven't seen the trailer, but I'm excited based on the still alone. I have to mention House of 1000 Corpses. Thank you to. I guess, Lionsgate. Thank you, Lionsgate, for sending me the new Best Buy exclusive steelbook version of Rob Zombie's 20th anniversary edition of House of 1000 Corpses, which, weirdly, does not have Rob Zombie's 20-year director's commentary track on the disc. They did it after the discs were pressed, so it's on the digital copy only. So I have the digital. I have it. I haven't watched it yet, but I'm excited to watch The House of Thousand Corpses with a new commentary, and the old commentary from 2003 release is also on there. So if you buy it, you do get a digital copy, but be clear, it is not on the disc, so it's kind of annoying. And Rob Zombie said in an interview that he's done with the Firefly movies, and he's done with making Munsters movies after doing one of those. The Munsters was exhausting. That was an exhausting movie to make. It took almost 5 years of nonstop pushing and being in a foreign country during the height of COVID. Was not as much fun as you would think. The whole experience was very draining. Probably as far as theatrical films go, we're done with the Fireflies. Maybe there'll be graphic novels or something like that. He thinks the three movies go together well. It took a lot of work to get the third one done, and no one's getting any younger. And Sid Haig, from the time we started talking about the time we shot it, his health declined so severely that he went from being one of the leads to barely being able to keep him on set for an hour. So I think we just got it in under the wire on making that trilogy. Totally fair. Filming has started, Jesse, on Ty West's Maxine, which we mentioned last week. Stars Elizabeth Debicki and Michelle Monaghan and Bobby Cannavale and Lily Collins and Halsey and Giancarlo Esposito and Kevin Bacon. And of course, Mia Goth. Who, Jesse? I'm so good. I'm like DJ. I feel like I'm DJing right now. I'm transitioning. Who is also in? Mia Goth was just cast in Marvel's Blade movie.
Yes.
Did you hear this?
Did you hear about this?
Jan Demange, the director known for Lovecraft Country, is at the helm of the project now after some other dudes left the project or something. I forget. Something happened there. That project has changed hands. But Blade stars Mahershala Ali as Blade, and I'm just worried about it as someone who loves the Blade movies. How do you feel?
I mean, I do feel apprehensive. If Marvel was as good as they claim to be about working in different genres and different tones and stuff like that, I would be excited for them to do something a little more horror-like. And I will say that Werewolf by Night thing they did had, you know, it was pretty distinct from their other stuff. It wasn't, they couldn't make it a movie, of course, but it was like, they did feel like a, you know, a tribute to old horror movies. And so I, you know, in theory, I really would be interested in them branching out into something a little more horror based. And certainly Mia Goth is a play for cred, you know?
Yeah.
She's a lot of horror movie cred. So I'm very excited to see her in it, but yeah, I'm not that interested in the PG-13 like quippy Blade, but maybe it'll be good. I don't know. Maybe they're getting beat up enough on their most recent movies that they'll let this one breathe a little more, but who knows?
Yes. Who knows? Truly, who knows? A24 dropped a trailer for Talk to Me, a movie coming out this summer, July 28th. I don't know where I talked about it on the show. I don't know if I did a Sundance episode this year. I probably talked it up because I loved Talk to Me. It was one of the best, maybe the only good horror movie at Sundance this year. And it was quite good. And I was delighted to see A24 pick it up immediately. From all I haven't watched the trailer, but I guess I could because I've seen the movie. Did you watch the trailer?
I did. It was in front of every movie I saw this weekend.
Dude,
that's not true, but a lot of them.
This has the biggest potential for a breakout hit for A24 that I think they've ever had. I think this very much feels like a regular studio horror movie that just happens to be, I think it's Australian or something.
Yeah, it seemed Australian.
Yeah, it's like it does seem like if the trailer's cut well and like gets the premise sold, which the premise, Jesse, does this the trailer sell the premise as it's like a party game, but it's like a Ouija board type of party game, but it's done with like this disembodied hand. Is that all in there?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's just a really fun premise that seems like easy sell. People will put their butts in seats and watch that movie, and it delivers. It's awesome, and it feels like it could be a franchise. So I'm definitely keep an eye on that one. I think that has a lot of potential. Faces of Death, the remake, directed by friends of the show, Issa Matse and Daniel Goldhaber. It started filming already. So he's going right from How to Blow Up a Pipeline in theaters now and on demand. I think now you can pay for it. I'm not sure. I think it is. He's going right from that, doing all the press to making fucking Faces of Death. So good luck to him. I'm excited to talk about the original Faces of Death whenever he has a moment to do so. James Wan's Atomic Monster lands 56 Days thriller at Amazon. Amazon Studios bought a James Wan Atomic Monster production, basically. 56 Days is a psychological thriller that tells the story of an intense, erotic romance that turns deadly. It follows two young professionals striking out on their own in a new city who are entangled quickly in a charged relationship that leads to a powerful intimacy that is soon cracked open by their secrets and to murder. This sounds like that Claire Denis movie from last year.
Both sides of the other one.
Oh. Is that the one? What's the other one she did last year? I can tell you based on that. But Both Sides of the Blade is not the one. It was the other one.
Right. It's the one with Margaret Qualley.
Stars at Night?
Stars at Noon.
It sounds a lot like Stars at Noon, which I did not care for. Anyway, Paul Schrader has set his next movie, and no, it's not the next one, which is coming out soon, called Master Gardener, which I think you and I both saw at New York Film Festival.
Yes.
His next one is reuniting him with Richard Gere, who they haven't worked together since, you know, the 80s. Was that when American Gigolo came out?
Yes.
What is this movie? The movie's called The Walker, an adaptation of an unnamed novel by Russell Banks, a personal friend and source of one of his best films, Affliction. Adrian Quinlan, author of The Curb piece, has confirmed Schrader will adapt Russell Banks' 2021 novel Forgone, which he hopes to title the movie O Canada, and he compares it to Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich. Let's see what we know. At the center of Forgone is famed Canadian-American leftist documentary filmmaker Leonard Fyfe, one of 60,000 draft evaders and deserters who fled to Canada to avoid serving in Nam. Now in his 70s, he's dying of cancer and has agreed to a final interview in which he is determined to bear all his secrets at last to demythologize his mythologized life. The interview is filmed by his acolyte and ex-star student Malcolm McLeod in the presence of Fyfe's wife and alongside Malcolm's producer, cinematographer, and sound technician, all of whom have admired Fyfe, but who must now absorb the meaning of his astonishing dark confession. Imaginatively structured around Fyfe's secret memories and alternating between the experiences of a characters who are filming his confession, the novel challenges our assumptions and understanding about a significant lost chapter in American history and the nature of memory itself. That sounds not only terrific, that already sounds like it's a Paul Schrader movie.
It does.
It sounds great. I'm excited about that. Skinamarink is coming to Blu-ray in June 20th, and there's a commentary track. So if you're a fan of that movie, I wanted to give you a heads up about that. Jesse, it is time for the main event. Renfield or Pope's Exorcist first? Which did you see first?
I saw Pope's Exorcist first. We saw that together, and then I went across town to see Renfield.
It was just like that movie, Mackenzie Davis Gets the Fuck Across Town.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever I Got the fuck Across Town.
Izzy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Izzy. Kind of a good movie, actually.
I don't think I ever saw it. It felt too...
Oh, the title. I was like, no, the title sounds, it makes it sound horrible. When I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, that's actually
I did good. See Brittany Runs a Marathon, and I did like it.
Yeah, well, that sucks. I didn't care for that. Love Julianne Bell.
She ran the marathon. Come on.
God.
And she found a lover along the way who was like stealing an Airbnb or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That was kind of funny. Bad movie though.
Bad movies. No, I'm just kidding. You like The Pope's Exorcist.
I kind of did like The Pope's Exorcist. I mean, I wouldn't make any claim to it being especially good, but as I alluded to earlier,
let me go get my notepad. You keep going. I'll be right back.
I'm kind of a fan of the Sony Scream Gems label. They've been around. I was researching this recently because I'm doing a list that's coming out around the same time as this podcast for Pace Magazine of the 15 best Scream Gems movies. Because that's pegged to the Pope's Exorcist being a Scream Gems movie, and also pegged to the fact that Scream Gems is celebrating its 25th anniversary later this year. Although its first movie was not until 1999.
What was their first movie?
Their first movie was actually Limbo by John Sayles.
What?
Yeah. Well, that's what I learned researching this, was that there's been a pretty big range of projects that fall under the Scream Gems banner over the past 25 years. And there are, especially early on, it was sometimes the movies that were maybe had considered a little more mainstream appeal than Sony classics, but were otherwise kind of in that budget range or, you know, scale. So early on, they released Limbo. They released Girl Fight with Michelle Rodriguez by horror auteur Karen Kusama.
Which I own on DVD for some reason. It's one of the very few DVDs I can have in my apartment.
That's why, because you can't get it anywhere else but DVD. Yes. At the moment, Snatch, the Guy Ritchie film, it's still his best movie, in my opinion.
In 4K on iTunes. For $5
Nice, terrific movie. I saw it like 3 times when it came out.
Wow.
So, and then they started also moving into kind of the more exploitation movies. I feel like the movies that really define them are Resident Evil and Underworld, which came out in 2002 and 2003. But even after that, they did In the Cut.
The movies that define them to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, are both of these screen gems. I'm basing it on nothing, but I think they're screen gems. Priest and the other one with Paul Bettany.
Yeah,
that is very similar.
I forget the name of it, but yes, Priest and another movie that I also saw, Legion, not the FX TV series. Priest and Legion, you know, those are super screen gem movies. Neither of those are super good. And a lot of screen gem movies aren't very good. But in making this list, I was especially appreciative of how they do kind of specialize in like fantasy, horror, action, you know, stuff that's in that kind of nexus.
Stuff that has a blue or green tint, I would say.
Yes. Especially blue or like gunmetal.
Mostly
gray.
Blue. I should have just said blue. But yeah.
Yeah, but there's some that are a little more colorful. They also have taken sidelines in doing like domestic thrillers with mostly black casts. Romantic
comedies.
Didn't
they do like Easy A and shit? Yeah, right.
They did Easy A and Friends with Benefits. So for a while they were like the Will Gluck arm of Sony. Some legitimately very good horror movies like Don't Breathe. Also some, you know, kind of more, you know, broad
Scott
comedies.
Derrickson one, like Deliver Us from Evil, which I walked out of, I think.
Yeah. they've done some crummy remakes, like Straw Dogs, and they've done some terrible, not terrible, just like not especially great, like romantic movies like The Vow. They've even kind of like done a couple musicals. They did like Burlesque and Country Strong. They're kind of like, if something's been disreputable at some point, a genre's been kind of disreputable, whether it's like movies starring black people or movies directed by women or movies that are about monsters or, you know, all those kind of things, they have dabbled in it, which I just appreciate.
You Got Served in 2004.
Yeah. They did a couple different dance movies. They also do like movies that are kind of in that budget range that a lot of big studios, as we were talking about earlier, Sony is sort of an exception, but a lot of big studios are like, no, I don't want to make something that costs 20 to 40 million. You know, I want to make
couple
something
more quintessential titles. Ultraviolet is a great one.
terrible,
Obsessed
terrible movie.
Is a great one.
Yeah, with Beyonce. Yep.
And
yep.
Takers is another good one.
Taker. I feel like Takers and Armored, which is Armored is really good.
Armored is really good. Nimrod. Yeah. That's a Nimrod.
Yeah. Two Nimrod. He also, yeah, they have kind of their own auteurs. Nimrod also did Vacancy, which I think is really cool. Good like limited location horror movie. It's like a little seedy, but it's not quite Hostel level. And actually they distributed Hostel overseas, in both cases, which I feel like that's almost better than distributed in the US.
Yes, it is. I'm sure it was much more fruitful for them.
Yeah. So like if a movie had like a vampires or a werewolves type of plot or an exorcism plot or like,
they're gonna teach this episode at Sony. They're gonna like
study the Screen Gems brand. You know, and there's some real actual gems in amidst the Screen Gems. Searching is really good. This is just talking about some stuff that was on my list. Don't Breathe, I think, is terrific. There was another one that was a little classier that I'm trying to think of, that I'm trying to place.
Anaconda sequel.
Yeah, I've never seen the again. Attack the Block. Really fun.
I think you mean the Wedding Ringer.
Yeah. Yes, the Wedding Ringer. I did see that in the theaters. Yeah. So like, I just appreciate this label and like what the kind of stuff they dabble in. They're not making best picture movies, but they are making
Vacancy
like,
is a good one.
Yeah, I just said Vacancy, the Nimrod. Yeah. The other Nimrod. Yeah. I appreciate what they're doing in general. Pope's Exorcist, in some ways, is super screen gemsy because it involves an exorcism, which multiple of their movies do. It has sort of a disgraced movie star, Russell Crowe, not in like personally disgraced, the phone thing was so long ago, but like a slumming movie star, I should say, like the way that Kate Beckinsale is slumming in Underworld, delightfully so. And it's also like, it's a horror movie, but it's full of like mythology nonsense and like kind of like fantasy overtones, I would say. Like it goes a little further than like the bullshit exorcism stuff, which I don't care for. I think we're together in not caring for the exorcism tropes at all, just because they're, like you said, they're not interesting. Like it's so hard to do these in an original way. And this movie does not like transcend the exorcism bullshit.
No,
but it very much does not. As a horror movie, I will admit that it's not very good. It's not scary. It's not a good exorcism movie. It didn't give me the chills or anything. But just as a kind of like
no tension, no suspense.
I'm making it sound great. But
yeah, put all of this on a poster, please.
Yeah, I sat there unmoved. But as a bunch of hokum, I kind of got into it and sort of enjoyed myself. It's and some of that is Russell Crowe's performance as the titular Pope's exorcist.
Him walking around to nuns and going like, cuckoo.
Yeah. Him like flirting with nuns and riding his scooter and
speaking Italian,
swigging from a little cute little flask, being kind of mischievous, but still like reverent of the religious bullshit. I found fairly delightful. I really like later period Russell Crowe more, I would say, than like peak movie star Russell Crowe.
Unhinged era?
Yeah. I still haven't seen Unhinged. I would definitely watch it.
Oh my God. You didn't go with me to New Jersey or whatever when I went and saw Unhinged in the peak of COVID?
I didn't make the trip. No. I'm gonna watch it someday because I do like old, like more. I don't want to say fat Russell Crowe because that's like, I don't mean to be sizist, and also because, like, I to be clear, I would say that meaning Jesse sized Russell Crowe, not not good physique Russell Crowe.
Yeah, you're gonna self-flagellate every time you say it. I'm gonna make you say it that way now.
Yeah, more of a Jesse style Russell Crowe. I do appreciate it.
He looks like fucking Eric Cartman in Unhinged. That's
he looks more slim in this one than he did in
they
the
really trailer. Shoot him for maximum size in that movie.
Yeah. I really enjoy a girthier Crowe. And I like him in his sort of character.
I can't believe you haven't seen the movie where he's girthiest. Come on, you gotta watch it.
Oh man, I'm gonna make Marissa stop watching our TV shows and watch that tonight instead. Stop everything. We need to watch Unhinged.
Like literally, who is streaming that? Is it on the Daily Wire or something?
It is not available on a service, so that will take it down off the list for a while. It's only available to rent for $4.
Hey man, it's $10 to buy. You're gonna want to revisit that. You should consider it. It's in 4K with Dolby Vision and Dolby Atmos.
That's what I call Russell Crowe. He's my nickname for him is Dolby Vision. I found his performance in The Pope's Exorcist really fun. It's like a perfect, I mean, Renfield will connect to this too. It's a masterclass in what you can get when you buy yourself a movie star. Because this movie without Russell Crowe would be quite dire. And one might argue, one named Brett might argue that it is quite dire anyway.
Yeah.
But he brought enough kind of silliness to it. And there was just enough, like, kind of the movie's just like goofy enough in general that I found myself, except for a part in the middle where I was sort of admittedly zoning out on it and kind of like starting to find it hard to follow, which is dumb because I'm sure it's not hard to follow at all. But apart from that, I was like, yeah, I'm kind of into this. Like, it's not good, but it's like a good drive-in movie. Russell Crowe's fun in it. I kind of like the dumb mythology of it. I'm kind of a sucker for anything where there's like hell as a physical location. See also Event Horizon, where like, sure, you know, you can like actually go to hell in a more direct way. And that's not, they don't go to, I don't want to get anyone's hopes up. They don't go to hell in this. It's not Spawn, but like there are geographic areas that are essentially closer to hell and like without God that are causing this exorcism. It's just like a bunch of like, this old abbey was actually built on a next to a well full of skulls that they didn't notice. I cannot make any great arguments for it being a great movie or, you know, even a very good movie. But I would say if you like Screen Gems garbage, which I do, this is pretty good. It's a better, it's, I would say it's better Screen Gems garbage than standard bearer, as you mentioned, priest or legion. It's not as good as most of the Underworld sequels or the Resident Evil sequels, all of which I'm pretty into. But I don't know. I think it's junk that I kind of enjoyed. I did not expect to enjoy it more than the Nicolas Cage Dracula movie. But in my heart of hearts, I did enjoy it more. And you know what?
Kind of crazy, yeah.
I laughed more, too, which is crazy. And I don't think it wasn't all bad laughs. It wasn't all like, this is dumb. I think it does actually get some genuine laughs. Like, not, it's not like hilarious or anything, but it's like silly laughs. Like, the movie kind of knows it's silly.
Well,
it could be sillier, but I still had a good time.
Yeah, let me stop you right there.
Yeah.
My like whole line on this movie is that it's a crime for a movie that is this silly, as evidence, like the first evidence that it's this silly is the title, right? Like a
yes.
movie called The Pope's Exorcist. It does have this the awareness that that's a silly thing. I guess I give you that. Like there is some base silliness to it, but for a movie this silly to be no fun at all, and like, I understand those flourishes you're talking about with Russell did make me laugh, too. I was right there with you. But, like, they're not enough for me to get past what is just the most useless fucking subgenre that exists. I think it's worth parsing that The Exorcist is one of the best movies of all time, I think. One of the greatest movies, generally, not even with the caveat of one of the best horror movies of all time, but I think it's that, too, obviously. But it really is wild how that movie has inspired the most creatively bankrupt subgenre, where that movie set the tone, it set the iconography, it set everything that that the subgenre has just taken as gospel. And no other exorcism movie has ever, as far as I can tell, please point me out the ones if I'm wrong. I'm sure there's ones I've liked still, but there's ones that I can't think of any that have broken the, like, what they look like, what they sound like, that yeah. they're mostly in bed and yelling stuff. Like, it just, like, it all seems like they're all banking on this template that we all know and think works because this genre has lasted as long as it has. But, like, this movie has not a single original image or sound in it. I mean, like, I guess you could say Russell Crowe on a Vespa is, but that is on Twitter also. You can, like,
yeah,
see it.
True.
On Twitter.
Yeah.
He's tweeting it all the time. this movie just really racks up tropes by the end. Or, like, I mean, early on it does, but, like, it starts off with the demonic possessed little boy looking exactly how you expect him to, scratching his face and having that be, it's like truly just exactly what the other ones look like, including the original masterpiece, to the voice, which sounds like it's a bad approximation of Mercedes McCambridge voice from The Exorcist.
I would argue that they inexplicably give it a British accent, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah, they do. It is. That's interesting. Okay. They've got the demon cutting messages into the body.
Yes.
They've got a Jesus on the cross bleeding. They've got a cross turning upside down. And then by the end, they even throw in, Jesse, my favorite trope, the bendy, herky, jerky, bendy girl.
Yeah.
Who is just climbing around the walls and stuff. So it hits every single fucking note that these movies always do. And it's all in there. And yet, zero scares, zero tension of any kind. So I just cannot in good faith like recommend it on the grounds that it's like silly and fun enough, because while I did laugh, I think at all the same things you did, maybe not all of them, but like I laughed at all the Russell Crowe-isms and the things that he's doing and the fucking silly things it does with like, please speak English now. like there are things that I laughed at and stuff, but it's not fun. And Russell Crowe is having fun. He's committed. Russell Crowe's committed to commitment to this role is commendable, and it is fun. I think it was fun for him, but I just don't think the final product is fun for me. I will give it this, Jesse. It does one of the funniest things I've ever seen a movie do, which a lot of these movies that you know are going to bomb and never spawn sequels, a lot of them end with a sequel tag that's clearly like, well, you're a guy on a mission. Here's your next mission.
Yeah,
this movie does that with the scene that sets up 199 more sequels to this movie. It is hysterical. That is maybe I should give this movie more credit for being silly, because maybe it knows it's being silly with that and think like, we'll set up 199 sequels. People will think that's funny.
Just to be safe. Yeah. And you know what? I would watch, I wouldn't watch 199 more, but maybe I would watch 70 or 80 more.
Wow.
Just, okay. No, I mean, that's an exaggeration, perhaps. But I did, I loved that. And I legitimately couldn't tell what they were trying to do by me. I think that was just like, they're just trying to make sure that once the Pope's Exorcist trilogy is complete, that they have enough to then do the Pope's Exorcist TV series, which would have a case a week. That could then run for 180 episodes. And then they would still have room to do a reboot after that. I enjoyed.
Well, yeah, they're clearly setting up the Pope's Exorcists at the
end
of this one.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And yeah, I joke about watching 80 of them, but okay, I would watch the next one. I would go out and Stubbs the next one when they refuse to screen it for us.
There's an interesting aspect to this, which I didn't realize until now, because I think I joked when we sat through the credits of the whole movie, and I was like, at the end, I was like, the Pope's Exorcist will return. Yeah. But like, there is a 007 quality here. Like, yeah. He is an Ethan Hunt to like the Vatican's MI, whatever the fuck is in Mission Impossible, or I'm mixing my metaphors, I don't know. But like, it is 007-y. It is Mission Impossible-y in the setup of the character and the movie. So like, I want to get on board with it. But like, even that feels like, okay, you're just doing Constantine. And like, it took me, like the opening scene here, which is like he coaxes a soul from a body to a pig and kills it immediately. Like, it's pretty fun. But all I could think of, like, I'm like, yeah, is Constantine a screen gem? It sure fucking feels like it.
No, Constantine's Warner Brothers.
Okay. Constantine is a screen gem, like,
in spirit.
Totally agree. But like, it has an opening scene, which to me is weirdly memorable, where they like trap a demon in the mirror or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, it just reminded me of that. It's like, it's a different gimmick, but it's the same flavor. And like, not to say you can't rip off a movie from 20 years ago. Like, that's fine. But I don't know. I liked that. But like, it made me, I guess it immediately made me go, well, the demons are fucking stupid, huh? But then like, the later demon comments on that demon being stupid. So I'm like, okay, this movie.
It's also confusing because maybe I just missed something. Crow's character refers to that opening scene as being the guy was probably he's supposed to be the sort of like sensible exorcist, because he was like, well, I don't even think that was a real demon. I think that guy was mentally ill, and I was just giving him the.
Oh, I forgot about this whole aspect of the movie wanting to have it both ways, in the same way that Evil, the TV show that I keep referencing on this fucking podcast, because every movie, the Pray for the Devil did the same thing, where it's like half the thing. I'll explain what Evil. I do this on every podcast a million times a year. I explain that Evil is a show that is a procedural, where every week it starts with exactly a scene like out of the Pope's Exorcist opening, where it's like, this guy thinks he's possessed, or there's some sort of supernatural element happening here. But through, you know, detective work and police work and whatever, you actually figure out, or mental health work, you figure out that it's psychological or whatever, and there's actually an explanation. And that's a great thing for a procedural show. I think the show's great. I think it does that really well, while also being a show that's like, oh, by the way, all this stuff does exist, though, in the world. And this movie does want to have it both ways, the same thing, where it's like, that's a great premise. It's basically stealing another great premise from that show. It's just, we're doing evil. We're doing possession, but we're debunking it. But not really, because the way that scene is shot, Jesse, it's clear that they want you to think there's actual demon happening in that scene. But like, I appreciate that they're doing it could have just been in his head and I'm just playing along. I'm doing the theatrics.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
It's strange. It is. It's funny too, because I described this movie to Marissa and she was like, why don't you just watch Evil? Because she watches it. She's like, if this is what you want, it seems like Evil would do this better.
Yes.
And it's probably true.
Yeah. Listen to your wife, Jesse.
Yeah.
Believe women. Okay.
Yeah. Believe women, especially about Evil. You're right. Like, and I think the stuff that I found most fun about this movie would be more fun if they didn't tie it to, okay, so he's like, you know, the Pope's exorcist. He goes on these cases and stuff, and the people close to the Pope don't like him, but the Pope has faith in him and all that. And then they kind of tie it to this extremely, as you say, rote and rudimentary, kid is possessed, kid's in a haunted, kind of vaguely
like,
haunted
this
house.
This movie was billed as, like, based on the real life cases of Father Amorth, who's like a figure so well known in the exorcist worlds that there's a William Friedkin directed documentary about this man.
Yeah.
So, like, I think they just really oversold that stuff too. Like, they just didn't. You're right. the big case that's a real case is just a fucking the exact thing we've seen 100 times already.
Yeah, that's disappointing, and they don't do a great job. They certainly don't do a great job with the what you're supposed to get out of these exorcism movies. And generally, I don't, because it usually sucks. But like the, you know, getting to know the family and caring about the family dynamics, they have characters who are kind of supposed to make you, you know, draw it into the family dynamics, and then they just do not do the job. So in that sense, yeah, it's like it's kind of a disappointment to watch Father Gabriele Amorth doing these, you know, doing this like vast, like supernatural conspiracy thing, but then like the result is like, and get this, a child was possessed and sits in the bed and yells stuff. Like, that is kind of a dull version of it, but there was enough of the other hokum that I was sort of drawn, you know, carried along with it. But I do wonder why. I don't know. I think it's just because it sells. Like, why it always needs to be the same old exorcism things. And I think there is a certain crowd who likes these movies who are probably more religious than
yeah,
I am.
Yeah, just like an if it ain't broke, we have a template, let's just use it. I don't
and
know.
And like, it yeah. did make a bit more than Renfield this weekend after.
It did. At a quarter of the cost of the movie or something?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. They were pretty even on Friday, and Pope's Exorcist held on over the weekend. And that's because there is a dedicated audience that, like, if you say exorcism movie, you give them a trailer with a couple of kids with things going
I'm
carved
sure
into their
Pray for the Devil did similarly, or maybe a little worse.
Yeah,
it Russell Crowe.
Right. It did a little worse because it didn't have Russell Crowe, but like for a movie that was one of the worst I saw last year, it did a lot better than some movies that weren't the worst movie of the year. And there is an audience that loves to see it's like a ritual. It's like it's kind of the Catholic angle of it, right? Is to see the same stuff. You go to Mass every week, and there's a lot of parts of Mass that are the same thing. I think people go to these exorcism movies and they got to see the same thing. They got to do the rites of the exorcism movie. They got to have, you know, the kid sitting in the bed. They got to have the worried mom. They got to have
the Vatican
voice.
Knew all along and is
yeah,
covering it
yeah,
up.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's like, and also, which is also wishy-washy because what they arrive at here is like,
the demons did this. It wasn't the actual people involved,
right? Which is, I have to admit, though I enjoy this movie much more, similar to that thing I just loathed about Pray for the Devil, which was, you know, attributing what is clearly
real
child abuse
horrors to demons,
to demons, especially in a way that is the way that an abuser will use that. Like, an abuser will say, oh, that wasn't really me, you know, that's not the true me. I was out, you know, I was drunk or I was possessed or whatever the fuck. And this one does that with, instead of child abuse, the Spanish Inquisition.
The demons did the Spanish Inquisition, so everyone's off the hook for that. Sorry.
Yeah, and like, that's far enough removed and less personal, even though it's obviously a much vaster thing than the child abuse in the made-up Pray for the Devil movie. That's so far removed that I was sort of able to enjoy the silly hokiness of like, oh, it was the demons that did the Spanish Inquisition all along. And that's kind of what they like to do. They like to kind of acknowledge the evils of the church, but within a framework that allows you to say, but there is, you know, God and there is goodness, and the church ultimately isn't the bad guy, even though there are people in the church whose main crime is like not trusting Gabriella here. So it, like, if you pull at it, it's really, you know, it falls right apart.
And all that subplot about the house and the evil being underneath it or whatever the fuck, like, that just makes this not only a generic possession movie, it makes it a generic haunted house movie too.
Yes,
it's just kind of weird.
I will say, I do think Julius Avery, who directed it, I haven't seen, it's Overlord, the one he did.
Yeah, it's better than this. It's good.
I heard it was cool. And I did see Samaritan, which he did with Sylvester Stallone last year, which blew. Terrible movie.
Huh.
But in this one, it's like kind of a quasi superhero thing. It's actually also kind of reactionary in its own way. It's like a very much like America's cities are, you know, cesspools of crime on the brink of anarchy. And you can only
I think you're talking about Bo is Afraid, which we'll talk about on a bonus episode, actually cutting in Patreon bonus episode as soon as we record it. Bo is Afraid is ready. We both saw it. We're going to talk about it. We'll drop it. After Evil Dead will come out next Monday, and then midweek we'll drop Bo is Afraid. But if you're a Patreon subscriber, that is this week's bonus, is Bo is Afraid will be there early as fuck.
Yes.
Go on. Sorry.
Yes. So like the where was I? The talking about the Julius Avery, the director. I was impressed. I thought he did a nice job using the widescreen frame. This is, sounds so douchey of me, but like I watching the movie, I was like, oh, I kind of like the way these things are composed. I think there's some nice, a lot of it is dark in that very, you know, exorcism movie. Under
it's weirdly like, dark. I wrote that down. I'm like, this one of those movies where it's like, turn the fucking lights on.
But there were some moments where I thought like, oh, I kind of enjoy the composition of this. I feel like I'm drinking in the set design a little bit because the wide compositions kind of give you a sense of space. And this is minor stuff, but I did think it was actually pretty well made in parts. It's not like an exceptional, you talk about like your favorite Screen Gems directors like Nimrod Antel or whoever else. It's not like that where you're like, oh, this is really pretty well crafted. But I did think, okay, this guy isn't a complete hack. He kind of knows what he's a hack in more of the more Sam Dwayne sense of like, you know, he's kind of a likable hack. Like he's it's hacky stuff, but it the movie is not incompetently made. I thought it was actually kind of nice looking in its own way.
Yeah, I'll give it the
faint praise, but I did enjoy that.
I'll give it the Ralph Ineson voiceover work. I did enjoy the boy sounding like Ralph Ineson, aka the Green Knight, and many other things.
What's this then? Give me the Reed Exorcist.
This then?
They should make all. They should definitely do that more in the future. Give them Cockney gangster accents when they're demons. Yeah, I agree with you though. This subgenre is really creatively bankrupt. And I don't even like the original Exorcist that much. For more on this, you can check our series on the Exorcism. But like those the Exorcist at least is like obviously resonant and well-made film, and like sequels are kind of interesting in their own ways, but outside of that series there are some I've enjoyed. I actually kind of like Exorcism Emily Rose because that was a
Screen Gem.
That's a Screen Gem. It's a cool, it's because I like they're able to introduce the courtroom drama aspect, and I liked The Last Exorcism, which introduced a found footage aspect, and also the guy being like, he was a guy who was like a charlatan at first, but then
right, kind which of led real. To my one of my favorite sequel titles, The Last Exorcism 2.
For real this time. Yeah, so like you can the few that I've enjoyed. And I would love to hear from any listeners who are like, oh, I there's this great Exorcism movie from like 1982 that you guys haven't seen.
People like The Taking of Deborah Logan as a recent one. I feel like there's a handful of ones I always hear, and they're okay. They're all fine. Like they all max out at 3 stars probably.
I would just love to hear if there are any, but yeah, I think you're right. If for the most part, it's what's interesting too, just like, you know, financially or culturally or whatever, those Exorcist sequels weren't really successful.
No.
Financially. None of them. They were all flops, basically.
Well, they tried two versions of the fourth one, and they still bombed.
They A-B tested it, and people were not interested in either one. And to the extent they were, they preferred the crummier one.
That's right.
But at some point, I don't know when it was. I think I want to say it was like early 2000s. At some point, the genre sort of escaped that. Because there have been really big hit. There have been lots of big hit exorcism movies that aren't.
Well, you just pinged my brain. The Exorcist, the version you've never seen before, came out in 2000.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. That's
and
right.
I think that started the fucking hit. Movement again, didn't it?
Yeah. And it's weird. I don't really care, but if I were the rights holders for The Exorcist, I'd be so pissed that like it helped kickstart this whole subgenre of movies, but then like they've never, you know, made any money off of the actual Exorcist since the first
one. Well, they're trying to make up for lost time with three David Gordon Green ones in a row or whatever.
Yeah, I'm sure the first one at least will be a big hit, even though it's not. It does feel like a kind of a rel. I think we were talking about this on Twitter, or someone was talking about this on Twitter. It almost feels like people were asking basically, is this going to be as big as Halloween? Because like it doesn't seem like it should be. And the first Exorcist movie was a much bigger hit than Halloween. Like that was like a Godfather level.
That's
Star
what like
Wars
my parents
hit.
Told me about that movie when I was a kid. Is like this people were throwing up in the seats. Like they all, it's like a story people tell. Like that movie was like a phenomenon as far as I can understand.
Yeah, so much much bigger movie than Halloween, but I do also kind of feel like the series, even though plenty of Halloween movies flopped too. The series of Halloween kind of survived in a way that The Exorcist as a series didn't. Like there's like enough people who like have affection for Halloween 4 or Halloween 2 or the Rob Zombie Halloweens. And there's not that. I mean, there are people who appreciate The Exorcist sequels, but it's not really the same level of, they're not playing those Exorcist sequels on AMC Halloween.
No, I would love a rep screening of either of those. I feel like I never, Exorcist 3 weirdly has It has a cult fandom now, but it took a long time.
But it's like if you had Halloween, if the Halloween series was like only Halloween and Halloween 3. Halloween 3 has a cult following, but like you don't have a big hit series without like Halloween 2 and Halloween 4 kind of propping it up and being like genuine hit. Or H2O was a pretty big hit.
Exorcist 3 now makes every list because it has the best jump scare in horror movies. Like that is like its legacy now.
Yes. Yeah. And I thought it was cool. I thought that movie was pretty cool. It was like one of the better Exorcism movies I've seen. It's Exorcist 3. But it's so interesting. Like, so are they going to be able to, I don't think that a new Exorcist movie has the same cachet as Michael Myers is back and Laurie Strode is back at the same
Ellen
time.
Ellen Burstyn and Linda Blair are back.
Yeah. Your old pals, your favorites. But at the same time, Exorcism movies in general do have a kind of baseline level of interest.
You're right. That's such an interesting phenomenon. Like, I'm so fascinated by the box office prospects for it, for that exact reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? Anyway, The Pope's Exorcist, not a great entry in the exorcism genre, but I didn't really think of it as an exorcism movie. I thought of it as like a hokey fantasy horror movie, which is kind of where it goes at the end. And I was enjoying
it. I wish the rest
more.
Of it were as pulpy and fun as the where it goes, I guess, is my my critique. This was a very, this was a great discussion of The Pope's Exorcist. I'm like, if people ever ask for like, what's the podcast about? I'm sending them this one. That felt like,
hey,
really
that's a nice discussion of The Pope's Exorcist.
We just ruined it. Fuck.
Yeah, that's no, if Marissa's listening to this going, God damn it, you mixed it up. Hates the Italian voice.
Let's see how we can work Italian voice into talking about Renfield. I'm very interested in how you would do that. Renfield to me is a fun idea, and the movie cannot wait to sprint away from it at any time. It is so confounding, the movie that this ends up being, because the idea of a movie that is about Renfield, who, if you are not into Dracula lore, which you better be, because Universal's banking on you being invested in Dracula lore, but if you don't know, Renfield's his assistant, his bug-eating assistant, who the bugs... He eats bugs to give him like Dracula style immortality powers or whatever. And Dracula eats people to power himself. So like Renfield's, the idea is he's like a less powerful henchman for Dracula. And the germ of a good idea in Renfield that like is a good idea for maybe the first 10 minutes of it, and then it kind of forgets to do any of this shit, is that Renfield, what if it's a very, I don't know if what era it feels like, maybe 2013 or something, but it feels very much like, what if Renfield was self-aware about the abusive like he was self-aware that he's in an abusive, toxic, codependent relationship with Dracula. Like, what if he knew that Dracula was a toxic boss? What if he knew, what if Dracula took place with modern sensibilities, I guess, is another way to put it. Like, what if the characters in Dracula were aware of how people talk in modern time about this type of stuff? And I think that is kind of a funny idea. And especially the movie is kind of clever with, well, they use that as a way into, yes, Renfield's in a toxic codependent relationship with Dracula. So he goes to meetings, like AA meetings, or, you know, meetings where support groups, I guess you'd call it. And in that support group, he listens to all these other people who are in toxic codependent relationships. And then this is where it gets really clever, I think, is he uses, like, you know, someone's talking about their horrific ex-boyfriend or current boyfriend or husband, whatever it is. And then he would go get that person and feed that person to Dracula.
Yes.
Which that I think before I saw the movie, I was harping a lot on, why the fuck would you make this movie? Like, you're making a movie with Nick Cage's Dracula, but you're selling it as Renfield. And like, no, like Renfield is not a recognizable character name. It just seems like, I'm sure people were wrong about it when they were like, Iron Man's not going to work. No one knows that character. But like, it feels right here where it's like, Renfield, no one knows what that is. It's not going to work. I just didn't get it. But that opening, I think that all happens pretty quickly, right? Like, all of that stuff made me go, I see how this sold as a spec script in the room. I think that whole thing is hilarious. But then you kind of realize, okay, maybe that was a great comedy sketch and not a great comedy movie, because they move away from that and just go through like cop stuff, crime stuff, just complete nonsense that all ends up being staid, boring action and gunplay. And you're like, what the fuck is this movie? Why is this a movie with Nick Cage's Dracula in it if you're going to do Awkwafina's a cop whose dad was a cop who died and she's fighting cop corruption? It's just like, I don't care about any of that.
No,
gem of an idea is so fun. And like, the only way it mines that for comedy is what? I think the joke is those people are all scummy, so they like they taste bad. Like they're all like bad people,
yeah,
and they're not. He wants like a bus full of young cheerleaders.
Yeah,
and Renfeld brings him these shitty abusive husbands or whatever.
Yeah,
so all of that is
people who are pure, and it is the blood is better and gives him more power if they're pure and innocent victims, which Renfeld is reluctant to provide because he's not a bad person or whatever.
I feel like you and I just spent more time parsing all that stuff than the movie does. The movie just does that intro, got me on its side pretty quickly, especially with that 1931 joke, right? Where they put them in the movie.
Yeah, that's neat. That's neat stuff.
Well, yeah, and then it also has really great makeup up top. And then I'll let you talk now.
Well, I was just going to say even the comic premise of the movie, which I do think can work totally, they are, even before, as you say, they sort of run away from it and start going to this idiotic crime plot that just is not very involving or does not make a lot of sense, does not make good use of Awkwafina, does not make good use of anyone
in
this movie.
I feel so bad for Ben Schwartz and Awkwafina, two funny people who left completely astray by this movie.
Yeah, they're both just not given the right, they just have the wrong, Ben Schwartz kind of has the right vibe for it, but it's just the material is bad. Awkwafina, who I do like, and as a dramatic actress, I thought she was terrific in The Farewell, and I found her, what I've seen in a couple episodes of Nora from Queens, I thought it's funny, a funny show.
Jesse, no one's ever watched that show, but I appreciate you saying that.
I have seen a couple of them. There was one where she drove a car or something.
They keep having Subway ads for new seasons, and I'm like, get the fuck out of here.
There's no way. I know. I'm like, there's the proof. She's in movies. She doesn't have a show. Come on. Don't be serious here. But I do like Awkwafina as Nora from Queens, which is how I refer to her often.
Of course.
But she
was the voice on the 7 train for a while.
Yes. I enjoyed hearing her slightly scratchy voice, especially now that
Park
she dropped
Boulevard. That was a really bad impression, like an old Jewish woman. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, she, you know, as long as she's dropping the black scent, it's fine. She has the wrong energy for this movie. The way she, or I think she's just probably not directed well, but like her energy is so weird. She's like has this kind of hunched. Her posture is bad. I was just like, she's not being physically well directed. They weren't like telling her. They weren't blocking her well. They weren't telling her how to stand. They're trying to sell her as like a badass. I thought the idea was that, that's sort of beside the point. Even early on, before you get to all that stuff that does not work, the movie has like three different openings mashed together because they're so impatient and antsy and just do not trust that the audience will get it. Because, okay, so there's three different openings here. You have 1931 Dracula done up with Cage and Holt inserted into those roles, which is not, you're not going to do that for 10 or 15 minutes, but that's a fun little montage.
It's like a 60 second gag, but it got a big laugh at the
yeah. Screen. Yeah. And I liked that. I certainly like seeing Nicolas Cage like inserted in the Bela Lugosi movie. That's funny. It's cute. And like, they don't belabor it too much. Great. They also have a nice, like in media res, Dracula and Renfield are caught by like a Van Helsing descendant once again, which is how Dracula gets like engulfed in flames and like burned halfway to hell and like is that low powers and needs to be replenished. Great. Like, yeah, that's a good thing to establish up front. And then there's also the opening of Renfield is at this meeting, this 12-step meeting, and describing a relationship with his boss, who is Dracula. The people on the meeting don't know this, but we are realizing this. And then the movie sort of stitches all three of those together in this like horrible. So it's like kind of bad. There's some bad writing in the kind of cutesiness of how some of these things are written out. But then there's a second layer of bad writing in the editing room as they rewrite it in the edit.
This movie, to be clear, very clearly tinkered with to the point of, I think it like fades to black and has freeze frames and shit and really bad tacked on, like, you're wondering how I got into this situation style narration.
Those three openings, all of which I like individually, are cut up and pasted together with narration to the front of the movie, just because they just don't trust that. It's clearly that the idea is get to it faster, don't have a whole scene where you gradually realize something. Just get to it faster. And the whole movie is kind of like that. There's no gradual realizations. There's no spending time with the characters. They're just like, get to it faster, damn it. Like, they just don't have any patience or any trust that the audience will have any patience whatsoever. So they try to goose it with adding narration with some extra quote-unquote jokes. They aren't really jokes. It's just sort of like, you know, it's more, it's like the kind of Marvel style thing of like irreverent attitude, but not actual jokes in the, there's no context.
Like, I can't believe that was the real Dracula. Dracula's here.
Yeah. That kind of thing. And it's so bizarre. And it's such a weird miscalculation of what the audience will go with, because there is a lot of good stuff in there, especially Cage as Dracula, who is so good that I almost would almost, not quite, but almost recommend
prefer
the movie.
A cinematic universe where they do more around him.
Well, yeah. Well, so, you know what? I didn't dislike that Mummy movie, so I would be fine with that. But I like the idea. I like the idea that they went with after, where they were saying, let's do these as like these auteur driven, not that connected movies. You know, obviously, I think that's a great idea. Love The Invisible Man. Love Universal Monsters. Would easily watch two Universal Monster movies a year if they were not, you know, all in the same continuity. Two new ones. I mean, I could watch way more than that in total. Yeah, obviously,
there's a lot.
Otherwise, I'd be halfway done after Renfield, and that will not do. I'll definitely watch some more this year. But it's just such a disappointment to see Cage's performance as Dracula, which is so much fun that I almost would say it's worth stubsing if you're into the Universal Monsters and horror and stuff. Just to see.
Yeah, I told someone to go see this the other night. I'm like, I agree. I'm like, I think there's enough good stuff in it where if you're interested, it's worth seeing, but I still think the end product is a disaster.
Yeah, the movie really doesn't work. Cage is great as Dracula, and you're right, the makeup in this movie, especially early on, is terrific. I was so excited. I was just like delighted watching those early scenes.
Yeah, like
of
Nick Cage and his face falling off, basically.
Yes. It's the stuff that Cage loves playing with makeup, and like he talks about the, you know, kabuki style of acting, or his maximalist style works so well with crazy makeup. There's some Cage flourishes in the acting, and really that I
think he says you who or yahoo in the middle of a line.
Does a better job of it than Mario, certainly, of saying yahoo.
He does. Maybe that's why he did it. We're opening against Mario. I'm going to destroy him.
Yeah. And yeah, I should have looked up who did the makeup and to praise them specifically, because they did a phenomenal job with the makeup in this movie, especially before he sort of gains full power. And even then, it's like cool, basic Dracula makeup. But when he's sort of rotting and then slowly
It's Christian
healing.
Tinsley, who's won an Academy Award for his makeup for Passion of the Christ.
Oh, good God. That was... Gory,
he did so True Grit. He's Buster Scruggs, so he's clearly Coen's guy. Fast Five, Jesse James, MIB3, Gangster Squad, The Pacifier.
He's done it all.
William Friedkin's Bug. That's a great one.
Oh yeah. Well, so I mean, I would be 100% in favor of this movie getting a makeup nomination. I can't imagine I would see four other movies or five other movies this year where the makeup, I'm not alone because Cage is great, but like I was grinning watching the makeup. How often does that happen watching a movie? Even a horror movie doesn't happen that often. We see like the, you know, I wasn't delighted by the makeup in The Pope's Exorcist, and the makeup at Renfield, I was just like, this is so cool. I was like, my friend Nathaniel, who's a big monster guy, I know wants to see this, and I was like fearing him seeing it because I think he'll probably find it ultimately kind of disappointing. But I was like, he has to see it for the Dracula makeup alone, which is a, you know, terrific compliment to the makeup. But the movie itself, my God, it is a mess. And I feel
why is there a running joke about ska in this 2023
honestly,
movie?
I kind of laughed at that.
Come on!
I chuckled. Mostly because I laughed because they name dropped very correct ska band names, where they were like, they name dropped Mustard Plug. And I was like, fair play. You like did your research on that. But I can pivot here. I can do a nice transition. So yeah, they cared. The writer cared enough to research, or maybe he just knows ska, but he...
I just assume he's a ska, old ska head. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He cared enough to get that right. But what the movie doesn't bother with is any real caring about or understanding of like Renfield's deal in the original Dracula, which like I had to refresh on it because I haven't read Dracula since I was like 17 or whenever I read it.
I rewatched the 31 right before, which was actually kind of helpful.
Yeah, I haven't seen that in a couple of years at least.
Even. It's not very good. I don't like it very much.
My recollection was that the Frankenstein, and especially Bride of Frankenstein, are like
much
way
better.
Cooler. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's got cool. It's like, and then like in Todd Browning's Freaks is way cooler than his Dracula, I would say too.
Yes. And Nosferatu is cooler than Dracula.
Yeah. There's it just loses out in a lot of categories here. It's not the best Todd Browning, not it the best Dracula.
It was outdone 10 years earlier in a silent movie, which is brutal.
That's true. I watched Nosferatu actually for the first time relatively recently.
Oh, it's so good.
Recently, and it was last year, and it was, I was like, wow, I mean, this movie is crazy good.
Maybe it's just because I took a German film class, but like, I love German expressionist films, and like, I love that look. I mean, it's just like expressionism.
That influence is all over those monster movies, but Dracula is a little it's a little creakier. It's like, and the original Invisible Man is so good. Again, kind of outdoes Dracula. The Mummy, I feel like it's Dracula is like on par
with the
original.
Welcome to the roast of 1931 Dracula.
But the thing is, that movie still has like atmosphere and obviously a great Bela Lugosi and everything.
Yeah, the performance, it's so funny. They're two, there's it's like a parallel. Nick Cage gives a great performance in this not good movie.
It's what's so I'm not gonna play like I'm in some expert on the text of Dracula, but I do know from rereading some of this stuff and just to like refresh my memory about Renfield, his character is so much more interesting and almost also more marginal than the movie makes it seem. And I know this is the whole deal, is that it's reoriented to be about this character, which is an interesting idea, but even they just sort of seem like they've watched Bram Stoker's Dracula, the 92 Coppola one, which I love, is really fun. And it seemed like they were mostly taking that and going, okay, well, what if we made a movie about this guy? And it's fairly faithful to the book, but like with what the kind of thing, someone else pointed this out line, I'm sure, but like the Renfield isn't like, this is getting into like dorky shit, but like in the movie, they make it so like, oh, he eats bugs and that gives him kind of superpowers to do Dracula's bidding. That's sort of what Dracula's given him, is like this superpowers with an asterisk, where if you eat bugs, you get like super strong and fast and stuff, and you can fight, but you're supposed to use that to do his bidding. The real in the Renfield in the book and in the Coppola movie even, is like, yeah, he's a minion of Dracula, but like the bug eating thing is his thing. Like he is in thrall of Dracula independently.
Yeah.
He's like a Dracula fan who like has sought Dracula out. And he has this whole system of bug eating that he thinks will give him Dracula style powers. And Dracula is like, oh, well, you know, if you do want to be my minion, I'll just give you tons of bugs to eat. Right. And he's like, sure. That'll give you powers like you think, like you already thought. But like the whole deal is that Renfield is batshit insane and is like eating bugs for no reason. He doesn't actually have powers. He's just like doing Dracula's bidding because Dracula is taking advantage of a mentally ill man who's also a fan of Dracula, which is a really interesting idea. And I wish the movie had gone a little more in that direction, at least in terms of how, his origin of how he, gets involved with. They just kind of make it like, oh, he was trying to get a real estate deal and he was greedy and whatever, which is like fine. I guess that's a fine oversimplification or whatever. But the movie is just so uninterested in those dynamics because it's so interested in the therapy speak stuff, which I can't tell if it just is genuinely enamored of therapy speak or just thinks therapy speak is hilarious inherently. It seems like a kind of a combination of both. But like, what should be the first act or the last act or like a scene is like the whole movie. It's just like, oh, he's in therapy and needs to overcome his codependent relationship. Like, that's not really a movie story to my mind, like, unless you're actually doing a recovery drama or something, which this most certainly is not, then why are we spending so much time with that? Like, when it's really just like, that's a funny scene that they thought up a funny scene, a funny sketch, and then sort of tried to build a movie out from it. But there is enough material, I think, in Renfield psychologically that you could go in any number of directions and have it be a full movie. But instead, they just go with, he has a bad boss, which, again, like the idea of that is kind of funny. And Cage plays it really well. I think Cage does a great job, like kind of mincing around and like glorying to his superiority to Renfield. And I saw an interview clip where he talked about like one of his influences, I'm sure like people talked originally about like, oh, he loves the Christopher Lee Dracula, or he loves he also loves the expressionist version of Dracula in Nosferatu. And then in an interview he was like, well, my main influences were my father and Anne Bancroft in The Graduate.
And you can see it when you watch it.
Yeah, when he said that, I was like, holy shit, you could definitely see that. And
Same issue, or not, I don't know if you call it an issue, but I read that before watching the movie. And then I saw the movie and I was like, he's doing fucking Anne Bancroft in The Graduate. How did he do that? Like, he's an incredible actor.
Yeah, it's really neat. And, like, that is a great attitude for Dracula. Someone who is manipulating a person, but feels like they feels very justified in doing so. That's such a great, that's a very good insight. That's what you get, again, with as with Russell Crowe and Pope's Exorcist, when you pay for your really good actor movie star, that's what you get, is you get this extra stuff. But the movie itself, really, I mean, like, look, there are moments I laughed and smiled, even at moments without Cage, although Cage was the main.
Well, there's a couple in addition to the great makeup, there's a couple inspired gore bits or in practical effects. But I say it so disdainfully because it's like a couple amid so much of the worst CGI blood explosions you've ever seen in this movie. Like, it is. The whole joke is, haha, look at all these blood and guts, but it just looks like garbage.
Especially, it's weird, like, because you know these things aren't done in order, but, like, especially in the back half of the movie.
Yeah,
The first couple of those, and you had told me that there was bad CG gore, because you know how much I hate CG gore. And the first bunch of it, I was like, oh, this is fine. Like, this is clearly augmented by computers, but, like, there's some real blood splatter in here. This isn't too bad. This certainly isn't egregious as far as CG gore goes. And then in the second half, there's a couple of, like, all-out battle royale kind of, like, people getting exploded and stuff. And it looks worse than stuff from, like, the end of Blade, you know? Like, you know the part where he becomes, like, the blood monster or whatever in Blade? It, like, looks that like that 30 years later, 25 years later. And it is really appallingly bad. It's too bad because, like, they don't have the patience to make just, like, fun gore. There are a few fun, like, gore gags, but... Like, I was thinking about Violent Night, another Universal sort of, it's not a monster movie, but it's like the horror adjacent, like, you know, wink, wink attitude kind of funny and violent.
How did that David Harbour movie open so much bigger than this?
Yeah, Jesus. Right. Jesus. I think the Christmas hook is really, that was like perfectly timed. Maybe this would have done better on Halloween. Who knows?
Yeah. But I mean, certainly would have done better opening against not a very similar movie, like, not even that similar movies, but similar crowds go to them.
Yeah, I think they both would have done a couple million more, if not even more.
I think I even saw the producer chiming in on Twitter post Exorcist, being like, "Hey, we overperformed. I'll take it, but I think we would have made five more if we opened another time."
And I was
You're right. You're totally right.
But Violent Night, even, which I was not a huge fan of, I liked a little more than you, but I wasn't, like, you know, over the moon about. Yeah. At least the gore gags in that, I thought there were, like, several quite good ones. The chimney thing in particular.
They feel written and, like, interesting. The ones in this movie are just, like, explosion. There's that one where he waves to Aquafina in slow-mo or something. Like,
yeah, that's kind of cute, but, like, it's not really enough. Yeah.
It doesn't look good. If it looked better, maybe it'd be passable.
And they're conceived so stupidly in terms of, like, you know, I'm not saying they need to be, like, adhere strictly to the laws of physics, but I am saying that if you are going to stab someone through the chest with an arm, it can't just be like, oh, it's like as if you stab them with a wooden stake. Like, an arm isn't the same thing as that.
Like, they're implying that there's some bone that's sharp or something. It makes you do a lot of you have to do a lot of work on that one.
Yeah, it's just work. Like, and I'm saying, like, look, use the human body as a disgusting playground all you want, for sure. I love gags like that. Like, I feel like there are a couple moments, even in some crummy movies like Violent Night, where you go, oh, that was kind of a fun, like, use of something really horrifying. Or, like, you know, we talk about the Studio 666 had, like, a great, horrible chainsaw kill that's, like, really gruesome and horrible. And, like, and that's played for laughs. And I'm all for that. Just this movie, it does it so lazily. It just does, you know, so haphazardly. Like, what if you, like, stabbed a guy with another body? It's like, well, you need to, like, think about how that would actually work. Even if it's in a fantasy world, you want it to, like, make sense within the fantasy world. And, yeah, so it's a disappointment.
It's just an epic miscalculation to make any of this about cops and crimes and gangs. And, like, it just... I just can't imagine anyone watching this getting excited to see an action sequence in this movie. Like, I can't, like, the bar is set too high for me for action now with, like, John Wick. This came out sandwiched between John Wick and Mission Impossible, whatever. And it's like, you expect me to care about action in this shitty fucking movie? I just, like, why would you even bother with that type of shit is my thinking. And, like, maybe some people enjoy that stuff, but I just really thought, it's just an epic miscalculation from the start where, like, this was never going to work in the form that you wrote it. It just isn't going to work. So the final form doesn't work either. And the narration, the only thing I can think of is that it sounds like Glenn and Glenda in Seed of Chucky, the narration. It has that same, he basically talks like that character. And then it just made me laugh when I realized that he does narration in the same style that Seed of Chucky has it.
Yes.
Yeah, there's one joke that I really think is funny that the trailer ruins, the TV spot even ruins. The, if I don't give him whatever, he won't grow to full power. And like, the why did you say it that way thing? Like, but that's such a Marvel type of humor, but it works sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, yeah, there's stray lines and moments where I chuckled, but not nearly as much as I should, considering it's like really trying for comedy. Yeah,
it's a bummer.
Yeah, it's I just wish, you know, I'm not saying, oh, it shouldn't have been a comedy, but maybe it just feels so sweaty about its desire to be funny. And it's very...
Well, that's where the dated stuff comes in for me. I'm like, this feels... Let me find my buddy Bill Bria, who's a great critic, said, here's what he said. There's an aspect of the character of Count Dracula, and by extension, his familiars like Renfield, that doesn't crop up in every adaptation, and it doesn't crop up beyond a few surface-level mentions and quips in Renfield either. The idea that this Dark Lord and those in his thrall are people hopelessly out of time. While that theme isn't much in Renfield the movie, it literally is Renfield the movie. The flick feels like it's been transported from 2011, back when geek culture was at its fervent peak. Everyone thought snark and postmodern sketch riffs on established characters was the height of savvy homage, and hyper-violent comedies where an F-bomb drops every 2 seconds in between gobs of CGI blood seemed edgy. Sadly, for 2023, it all feels hopelessly dated. And to add insult to injury, the film feels like yet another simmering attempt of Universal Studios being a little shamed of their classic horror monsters. It's clearly in love with the history of Dracula, and isn't trying to take the piss out of the character vampire film so much as have a fun romp with them. But it's all been there, done that, leaving Nicolas Cage's turn as a vampire the only true example of wicked weird inspiration in the movie. It all generally works fine and isn't nearly as painful to watch as its louder detractors say, but it's also difficult to defend something this ironically, given the script's themes, weak-willed. That is a great blurb.
Yes, that is, wow, very well written. And I agree 100%. I think it's watchable enough, especially because of Cage. And I like, you know, Nicholas Hoult and Awkwafina, I like in other things, and that kind of gets you through their performances here, which are not their strongest work. It's watchable enough. And I agree, it doesn't fall into the trap of just like being like, oh, Dracula's dumb. Isn't this all dumb? Like, they just actually take the Dracula character seriously, which I enjoy. But it just, the movie is so like, I wouldn't even say pleased with itself. It's almost like it aspires to be pleased with itself. It's very weak-willed, as he puts it, is the perfect way. It's a very insecure movie that doesn't believe that it's kind of good enough to succeed like, on its own.
Some person's going to be like, it's brilliant, because that's how Renfield feels.
Right. If that's what we, in creative writing workshops, that's what you call an imitative fallacy. The idea that because it's boring, because what the characters are experiencing is boring or whatever, then the story should be boring. But that's not true. Like, that's not a rule. You don't want things to be, you don't want someone to experience boredom by making something boring. You want to be, you want to evoke it in a more involved way for your audience. So I could totally see how the movie does kind of feel Renfield-y in that way. But if that was the intention, and I don't think it was, I think the movie's just sweaty. But if that was the intention, it does. That's just,
yeah. Way to go. You made your movie not enjoyable.
You made your movie kind of an annoying twerp like Renfield. It's a shame. I really, even after hearing some bad stuff, I was like, come on. And I'm not wildly down on it. Like, I was kind of
right where Bill was.
I'm like a 2.5 star. Like, all right, I wasn't bored during this, but I was pretty annoyed during parts of it. I felt at the same time, while feeling like really weirdly grateful that I got to watch this Nicolas Cage as Dracula performance. He was in it a little more than I thought, even though he's clearly a supporting character. I was like, honestly, he's actually in it a fair amount.
He's probably in it more than Dracula is in 1931 Dracula, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Dracula in general, you hardly ever have a Dracula movie where he's the point of view character. So
he's treated like Pinhead in a Hellraiser sequel. You don't see him until an hour and 20 minutes into a 90-minute movie.
Yeah, and with The Last Voyage of the Demeter is clearly doing that too. Like, Dracula's not the main character in that movie. He's going to be in the shadows, like, you know, killing fools.
Yeah, he's not played by an actor or an actor that's recognizable. It's just like a guy. Yeah. Some fucking guy. Oh, I forgot. The Invitation, the stealth Dracula movie from last year.
Yeah.
Was that a screen gem? Wasn't it?
It was a screen gem, yeah.
That is wild. Anyway, I'm glad I mentioned the Bill Bria quote, because Bill was supposed to be on the show to cover Hellraiser when we were going to do the reboot. And then I just kept putting it off and it's just never happened. So I'll have to get him on for something else. He is one of my first reads on Letterboxd always, and wherever he is writing. That's not Letterboxd. I'll use that plug to segue into another plug. Last week, we had George Heffler of the Best Little Horror House in Philly on. And I realized afterwards, Jesse, that we asked him about his show that he was plugging. Mm-hmm. I asked him before we started recording. So like none of that stuff made it to the podcast. So I will say there's still time. I will do. This is George's plug from last week. The Best Little Horror House in Philly has a live show at Philomoka here in Philly. They're screening Tetsuo the Iron Man at 6:30, followed by a live recording of the Best Little Horror House in Philly podcast at 8 p.m. That is on May 4th. Tickets are available at philomoka.org. You can follow Best Little Horror House in Philly on Twitter, at Little Horror PHL on Twitter. So shout out to George Heffler. Thanks for doing the pod last week. Shout out to us. Do the Patreon. As I mentioned earlier, we'll have Beau is Afraid up this week, which Jesse and I have both seen. I will have seen a second time in IMAX, hopefully, by the time Jesse and I talk about it. I'm very excited to talk about it. Let's say up top, not a horror movie, but it does feel like you're living in someone else's nightmare while watching that movie.
Yeah, I would say I was actually surprised because like I heard it described earlier this year as like, well, not really horror like his other ones. And that's true, but it's more of a piece with those than I would have guessed. I mean, like it's violent and scary. So like, how is that not horror, right? It's like you said, it's a nightmare. It's definitely, to me, it qualifies in a weird way as horror.
Yes, I do think there's an argument to be made, and we will make it on the episode that will drop, I believe. What is this? It'll drop next Wednesday, but it'll be out on Patreon now, I guess, or this Wednesday. I have my time all fucked up. It'll be out sometime soon, and if you're on Patreon, it'll be out earlier. Okay, bye.
Lifestyle.
You'll forgive me if I don't stay around to watch. I just can't cope with freaky stuff.